Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. As President Jimmy Carter helped negotiate the historic peace agreement between Israel and Egypt, the Camp David Accord showed the world that peace was possible between an Arab nation and Israel. Jimmy Carter has been a tireless promoter of peace since leaving the White House in 1980. Now, in a new book, he offers a plan for achieving a lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians. The book is titled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. And President Jimmy Carter joins me in the studio. Throughout the hour, we will invite your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Mr. President.
Diane, it's good to be with you again.
It's wonderful to see you. Over the weekend, Jordan's King Abdullah said something really dramatic. Must come out of the meeting between President Bush and Prime Minister Maliki. He said that unless something does happen, you will have three civil wars in the Middle East. You will have between the Palestinians and the Israelis, between the Lebanese and between a third group, the Iraqis. Now, what do you see coming out of that meeting with Prime Minister Maliki that could change the situation?
Well, I don't see much of substance coming out of the meeting between President Bush and Prime Minister Maliki, unfortunately. As you know, Maliki is so dependent on the political support of the radical Shiites, that he's not a free agent, and he has to accommodate their demands. And it's their demands, I think, that are crucial in ultimate progress. There's no doubt either, though, that President Bush will exert his maximum influence to urge Maliki to take a much more bold and aggressive and substantive decision and try to implement that decision within the government and society of the Iraqis. I think what King Abdullah said is very pertinent, because we have lost a lot of our historic friendship and support and respect within what we would call the moderate Arab world, or Jordan, or Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and so forth, because there's been absolutely no effort made in the last 6 years to bring any sort of resolution to the issue between Israel and the Palestinians. And the entire Muslim world, in fact, much of the non-Muslim world too, has been deeply concerned that for 6 years there has not been a single day of effort to have a peace talk between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And so I think that they are interrelated more than most people had realized before King Abdullah made his statement. But the entire Middle East, including the Gulf and all the way through the Holy Land, are intimately intertwined as far as public opinion is concerned and ultimate resolution of the Iraqi war.
Now, over the weekend, Mr. Olmert said that he was about to institute a ceasefire with the Palestinians if the Palestinians would indeed come to the table and promise not to fire any weapons into Israel. Do you see that as realistic? Do you see a ceasefire such as that, which is already in place, holding?
Well, I read the assessment of his speech, actually in the New York Times this morning, that characterized it as non-substantive, as having no new issues to raise. I think the agreement by Israel to withdraw from Gaza and by the Palestinians not to fire any more of their rockets from Gaza into the nearby towns in Israel is a notable step forward. But Prime Minister Olmert's statement was that he was still assuming that Hamas was a terrorist organization. Secondly, that he would not withdraw to the 1967 borders, and that they would have to give up any prospect for the return of Palestinian refugees to their homeland, even in Palestinian territory, not including the nation of Israel. So there's not any major step in prospect at this time. And one reason I decided to write this book was to kind of get the United States public opinion and maybe some public officials and those in Israel and other places more in a desire or commitment to restart the absolutely dead peace effort that now prevails in the Holy Land.
How central do you believe this difficulty, this war between the Israelis and the Palestinians, how central is it to what's happening in the rest of the Middle East?
I don't think there's any doubt that the failure in the last number of years, even to attempt to resolve that difference, has sent a signal, maybe an erroneous signal, that the United States just doesn't care. And that contrary to all previous presidents, including Bill Clinton and George Bush Sr. and I and others, that this administration has made no effort at all to bring the two parties to the negotiating table. And this is, I think, decreased dramatically the public approbation or respect for the United States, even among the closest friends that we've had in the Arab world. A Pew poll that I saw not too long ago showed that less than 5% of the citizens of both Egypt and Jordan looked with favor on the United States now, whereas they used to be almost unanimously favorable toward our great country. So my hope is that at least we can start something going in order to address this this present debacle. By the way, you mentioned war. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't characterize it as a war because not many people are being killed. As a matter of fact, no Israeli has died since August of 2004 because of a so-called terrorist attack from Hamas. Almost all the casualties in recent months have been inside Gaza when Israel did invade Gaza again, and now they're going to be withdrawing, and that should remove that threat of continued loss of life in that region.
And, of course, there has been a great loss of life on the Lebanese side from Israeli attacks.
That's exactly right. Obviously, Israel has a right to defend itself, and it was a tragedy, in my opinion, when Hezbollah captured the two Israeli soldiers, which precipitated the conflict. Subsequently, of course, Israel declared that it was not just a Hezbollah attack, but an attack on Israel by the entire nation of Lebanon, and responded accordingly. And I think that both sides have confirmed that Israel bombed 6,000 different sites throughout most of the nation of Lebanon with enormous casualties. At the same time, of course, the Hezbollah was firing rockets into northern Israel. So at least now we have a ceasefire there, And although none of the three major issues were resolved at all, even in the United Nations Resolution 1701, one of the issues was an exchange of prisoners. That was one issue. The second issue was Israel's withdrawal from a small area in Lebanon. And the third issue was the disarmament of Hezbollah. And, of course, when the UN did act, they circumvented or bypassed or finessed all three of those issues. Now, though, with increasing numbers of Lebanon troops and international troops in southern Lebanon, my belief is that for the foreseeable future, there won't be another outbreak of violence across the Lebanon-Israeli border.
Former President Jimmy Carter, his new book is titled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. You can join us 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. In 2005, you hoped to travel to Syria, but you were told not to go. Yes. Tell us about that.
Well, I go to the Mideast quite often and have ever since I left office. And, for instance, we have monitored all three of Palestinian elections, beginning with the election of Yasser Arafat in 1996 in January. And then after Arafat died, we monitored the election for his replacement, Mahmoud Abbas, or Abu Mazen, who took over as president of the Palestinians. And then early this year, we went over to help with the election of the parliamentarians when Hamas won a surprising victory, as you know. But when I was preparing to go over there, I routinely, before I go on a foreign trip, I always clear my agenda, itinerary, with the State Department and the White House. So I sent them a notification that in order to prepare for this book and to help maybe, that I was going to visit different countries around Israel as well as the West Bank and Israel itself. And I pointed out that I wanted to visit Syria to meet with Basham, the young man who replaced his father as the president of Syria. And the White House called me immediately and said, no, do not go. I'll cover that in just a minute.
Former President Jimmy Carter. We'll be right back. Former President Jimmy Carter is here in the studio. We're talking about his brand new book. It's titled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. You can join us with your email to drshow@wamu.org or 800-433-8850. Mr. President, just before the break, you were talking about your decision to travel abroad in preparation for your book, going to various countries in the Middle East, and you ran into a roadblock.
Well, I had been going to Syria for many years. In fact, the first time I met with President Assad, the president of Syria, was in 1977, when I met him in Geneva. He said that he had no intention of ever visiting the United States, despite my invitation, and he never did. But while I was going to Syria on occasion, as I did to all the other countries in that region, as a matter of fact, President Assad brought his whole family in to meet me in Roseland, and I met his wife. The U.S. ambassador didn't even know he had a wife. And all four of his children, including his young son, Bassam, who later became president. So I told him, when the White House told me that I couldn't go to Syria because they wanted to isolate new President al-Assad, I said, well, I've known him since he was a college student, and I think that maybe if you have problems with Syria concerning Iraq or concerning Lebanon, that I might be able to help. And he replied to me, it's the official position of the White House that you not go to Syria under any circumstances. The leaders of Syria ought to be isolated from contact by prominent Americans. So I protested vehemently and obviously had to comply with their request.
Is that the first time you've ever been turned down in requests traveling abroad?
It's not the first time I've ever been turned down for requests, because I was planning a trip to Africa early in 1991, and President Bush Sr. called me and said that they were going to launch an attack on Iraq at that time, and since I was going to several prominently Muslim countries, he thought my safety might be in danger. So I decided not to go. But I have never been specifically prevented before from meeting with a foreign leader.
I see.
I think I could have helped, but, you know, that's just a conjecture.
Syria is clearly a key player in the region and
Absolutely.
Certainly affecting both events in Israel and Palestine and in Iraq. How should the U.S. approach that regime?
Well, I think that's one of the clear prospective recommendations of the Lee Hamilton and James Baker Commission, that we should consult with al-Bashir, Assad in Syria, and also consult with the Iranians and try to bring them in along with other prominent players, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the other Gulf states, and maybe even some outsiders like France and Russia. To assure the Iraqi people it's not just a United States occupying force that's interested in their future, but the entire world that is related to them wants to join together to make sure that they have a future of relative independence, to make their own decisions, to handle their own military affairs, to handle their own political and economic affairs. I think that's going to be one of the recommendations, which I certainly would approve. And they've already made it plain, I think, the members of that commission, maybe without authorization, that recommendation would be that we do include Syria and Iran along with others. So I think that's one of the moves that can be very clearly anticipated.
The concern that many people have is that no matter what the recommendations from the Baker Commission, this administration will say no.
Well, I think there's an increasing anticipation among the American general public and among leaders in the White House and in the Congress, and Senate and House, Republicans and Democrats, that this commission is the best unbiased bipartisan analytical possibility for the current situation and what might be done in the future. And I think although President Bush might decide to reject some of their recommendations, I doubt that he would be willing to say, I refuse to accept these recommendations in their totality. He might pick and choose. But I would guess that if the commission does reach unanimity, that's what James Baker told me he wanted, and I think he can get it, on a time schedule, that might be something where President Bush would say, I don't agree with having a time schedule.
For
withdrawal of our troops. But I think to include a broad-based involvement, in including Syria and Iran, I would doubt that he would reject that.
The British government has indicated that by the end of 2007, it's going to draw down its 9,000 troops currently in Iraq the German government, which has far fewer troops in Iraq, has also indicated it may draw down. Has the time come, Mr. President, to bring U.S. troops home?
Yes. There's no doubt about that. I have been adamantly opposed to the war since before it began. And I think it was one of the most tragic mistakes ever made in our diplomatic history. But I think at this point, a peremptory or immediate withdrawal would be unacceptable. There are two factors, though, that are obviously being considered. One is to send a clear and unequivocal signal to the Iraqi government leaders, whatever government it is, that the United States is not going to have its troops there permanently, and they are going to have to be forced into taking actions on their own to control the violence. That's one thing. The other factor is unpredictable and unprovable in the future, and that is how much of the violence is directly attributable to the fact that American troops are present as an occupying force. I think a substantial portion of the violence is due to that factor, and my opinion is that for American troops to be withdrawn from the troubled areas around Baghdad and so forth into maybe isolated regions as a first step, and then the number reduced, and with a clear signal for the future from Washington, which we don't have yet, that we intend someday to withdraw all our military from Iraq, would be a very beneficial thing.
So you're talking about the start of redeployment of forces to areas not only outside the troubled regions, but really perhaps into Kuwait,
yes,
perhaps into other areas nearby that could be reemployed if necessary.
Yes, I think to some isolated desert bases inside Iraq, even for the first step. And I, obviously my own preference would be to have a substantial withdrawal of the total number. We now have 140,000, 150,000. To cut that number in half within the next 6 or 8 months would be my own preference, but I don't know what they... I think there's still some intense debate going on within the Hamilton-Baker Committee about what we're discussing at this moment. How many to withdraw and when to withdraw, I think that's still up in the air.
Do you believe that partition of Iraq is on the table?
It is on the table. You know, it's been discussed quite at length, and I think the Kurds in the north would strongly favor it, maybe almost unanimously. We want to have our own tiny semi-nation with maximum autonomy. And I don't think there's any doubt that the Shiites in the south would also prefer this, because those two places are where all the oil exists. And what's left in the middle is controlled by the Sunnis, and they're clinging to the hope that the nation will not be divided and that they will share in a somewhat equitable way with the income from oil sales. So I think that there's already a strong move inside the inner circles of Iraqi government in that direction. And I know that some very prominent people in our own country have advocated the division of Iraq into three parts.
There has been great reluctance on the part of some U.S. officials saying that any substantial withdrawal of U.S. forces could lead to civil war in Iraq. Many people believe that we already have civil war in Iraq. Do you believe that?
Well, I think this is kind of
is it a term of art?
I think the semantics are only that. They don't have any substance. I think that some of the major news media have decided this week that from now on their correspondents are going to refer to it as a civil war. But, you know, compared to other civil wars with which I, at the Carter Center, have been intimately associated, this is not a civil war yet. We have devoted a good bit of our time for the last 20 years trying to resolve the civil war, for instance, in southern Sudan. Mm. 2 million people have died. And we just finished helping hold the first democratic election in history for the Republic of Congo. 4 million people have died there in the last 8 years. So compared to those so-called civil wars, this is not a civil war, but I don't think there's any doubt that it's civil strife. And I think it's just a matter of the news media deciding this is what we want to call it as a shorthand expression. I don't think it has any substance.
But from the Department of State's point of view, from the White House point of view, why is it that President Bush continues to say, we do not have civil war? We, as he said yesterday, what we have are al-Qaeda trying to gin up the action.
Well, there's been a substantial amount of self-delusion in Washington about the status of the conflict in Iraq, and the permeating distortion has been to underestimate the seriousness of the conflict. And for a long time, there was a denial that there was even any such thing as civil strife. It was always outside terrorists who had sneaked in across the border and were perpetrating these atrocities on the innocent people of Iraq who really wanted democracy and freedom and American brotherhood. Those kind of claims have now been discounted because of the force of events. So I don't think it really matters to be repetitive, whether NBC calls it civil war and the White House calls it something different. But I think there's a general consensus now that military power from the United States or any other outside force is not going to resolve the issue. As a matter of fact, lately, as you know, the presence of the U.S. military has been minimal compared to what it had been in the past. The big conflagration that resulted in Baghdad about a week ago, where 200 and something people were killed in one time, I noticed that Americans' troops arrived there only 2 hours after the explosion. So we're staying more withdrawn than we had been in the past.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And, of course, President Jimmy Carter is here with me. His new book is titled Palestine Peace, Not Apartheid. Jimmy Carter was 39th President of the United States. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002. He's the author of numerous books, including An Hour Before Daylight. He and his wife, Rosalyn, founded the Carter Center in 1982. Mr. President, when was the last time you met with President George Bush?
The last time I had a definitive and somewhat private discussion with him was after I returned from helping to monitor the election in Palestine in January of this year. And after the election was over, it was an honest, fair, open, safe, well-conducted election. And Hamas had prevailed in a surprising way. I discovered that that the United States was planning to join with Israel and others in withholding all aid or incoming funds from the Palestinian people as a punishment to the Palestinian people for the way they voted. And so I expressed my views quite clearly to the leaders in Washington. And
to President Bush himself.
Yes. And also I wanted to express my my concern, or perhaps consternation is a better word, at the building of the enormous wall that really is designed to imprison the remnant of the Palestinian people in a small portion of land left to them, and to acquire and to hold for Israel increasing areas of Palestinian land. This wall is in occupied and populated territories, ranges from heights of 25 feet to 40 feet, which is the height of a four-story building. And it is entirely located on Palestinian land. Excuse me. And I wanted to express my concern to President Bush about the adverse impact of this wall as a permanent barrier to Pargastud peace. So those are the kinds of things that I've discussed with President Bush. I do primarily consult with the administration through the State Department rather than bothering the president directly. For instance, the last time I talked to the State Department, Secretary Condoleezza Rice was asked when we completed last month the election in Nicaragua. And when I ascertained the results of the election, the Sandinistas won. That was the first time in four elections that they hadn't lost. We had a long talk with the newly elected president who's going to take office in January, Daniel Ortega, and I called Secretary Rice to give her the results of that election.
Some of these elections have not gone as the U.S. had foreseen and hoped they might go. President Jimmy Carter is with me. His new book is titled Palestine Peace, Not Apartheid. And when we come back, we'll open the phone. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University. Additional support for NPR comes from the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants both to promote international understanding and address the root causes of global poverty, online at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Why is it that for some young women today, empowerment means taking their bathing suit tops off on camera for Girls Gone Wild? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Arielle Levy, author of Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. Former President Jimmy Carter is with me in the studio. He's written many books, and of course you know he won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002. His new book is titled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. There are no marks of punctuation in that title. And he's here to take your calls, your comments, questions, 800-433-8850. First, let's go to Oklahoma City. Good morning, Eric. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane. President Carter, I want to say it's an honor to speak with you. I admire your work and all your humanitarian efforts that you've put out in your career. My question is, how realistic is it to expect peace and democracy in a region of the world with such radical and different religious and political views when you're using so much force? Is that a realistic... A realistic agenda to expect peace through force in that area of the world?
Well, thank you, Eric. The answer is yes. I'm an optimist, but I'm not an optimist based on what I've known in the past. When I became president a number of years ago, there had been five full wars in 25 years, primarily led by a powerful enemy of Israel named Egypt. And I brought those two leaders together at Camp David and negotiated a peace agreement, a peace treaty, as a matter of fact, not a word of which has been violated now in more than 26 years. So that's a proof that peace can come between Israel and her neighbors. And since then, of course, Jordan has complied. In addition to that, the agreement was that Israel would withdraw from occupied territories and would withdraw its military and political forces from the West Bank and Gaza and so forth, and give the Palestinians full autonomy. And that was approved by the Israeli government. Later, and I'll be very brief, in 1993, the Norwegians negotiated another agreement between the leaders of Israel, led by Prime Minister Rabin and Yasser Arafat, both of which received the Nobel Peace Prize. And that was another peace agreement based on Israel's agreement to withdraw from the occupied territories. So it's not a hopeless case. And unfortunately, outsiders have had to participate, and the tragedy is that in order to get peace for Israel, there needs to be some outside interference or some outside help. And in the past, the United States has been eager to do that, but for the last 6 years, there's been no effort made. So it's not a hopeless case.
Here's an email from Igor, who also wants to know about the Camp David agreement. He said, when Mr. Carter negotiated that agreement, was the amount of money to pay to Egypt an issue? And if so, why should not Syria expect a similar amount?
No, there was no agreement between me and Sadat at Camp David or subsequently to give Egypt so much money, or any amount of money. As a matter of fact, Egypt tended to prevail, I think, in that agreement because Israel was occupying a major portion of Egypt's territory in the Sinai Desert, all the way from Suez to presently Israel, and Israel agreed to withdraw from the Egyptian territory. The only thing that Egypt ceded was a chance for Israel to use the Suez Canal. So there was no reason and no promise to Egypt for any monetary compensation.
Here's an email from Martin, who says, it's amazing, President Carter, you always stress the suffering of the Palestinians, with which I can agree. But as history tells us, all the wars and flare-ups always come from the Palestinians. The Israelis have a right to defend their citizens just as the U.S. or France would. When they send suicide bombers and rockets to kill civilians, should they let them get away with it? It's their right to retaliate. You should also mention the Israelis don't live up to their agreement from Camp David. How can they, when they don't even recognize them as a state? And by that, I'm sure he means the Palestinians don't recognize Israel as a state.
Well, the key obstacle to peace in the Middle East is Israelis' occupation of land that belongs to other people by international law and by the agreements that I've just described to you at Camp David and later at Oslo, and also by the International Quartet and its so-called roadmap, which calls for Israel to withdraw from occupied territories, and Israel doesn't do that. As a matter of fact, there hasn't been any allegation of a terrorist attack from Hamas that resulted in a single Israeli death since August of 2004. And I'm very proud to know that now there is a tentative agreement. I hope it will be fulfilled, where Israel and the Palestinians agreed to stop any sort of deaths or attacks within Gaza. As a matter of fact, the capture of the Israeli soldier is what precipitated the recent invasion of Gaza in June. And I deplore that fact, this single soldier was captured by when Palestinians tunneled under the Israeli wall and took the soldier into Gaza. That's a tragedy. But at the same time, you have to realize that Israel is holding 9,200 Palestinians prisoner, and the Palestinians offered to swap that prisoner for just a portion of those that Israel holds, including about 100 women and about 300 children, some of them as young as 12 years old. But the Israelis refused to swap the prisoners they were holding for the one prisoner that the Palestinians were holding. So you have to know both sides. But I have to agree with you, Martin, that there's plenty of blame to go around.
Here's an email from Melissa who says, apartheid is the right word. I traveled through Palestine in March, including the Gaza Strip. When I returned to the U.S., the only word I found that effectively described the situation there was apartheid. I applaud you for using it. Americans do not know how the Palestinians are being treated. If they had the opportunity to see it, most Americans would be appalled. Will you describe for us, Mr. President, how Palestinians, many of them, are living now?
Well, Alyssa is absolutely right. I don't believe that any objective American could go to the occupied territories and deny that there is an element of apartness enforced by dominant Israelis on the subservient and abused Palestinians. And I made it plain in the title that I was referring to Palestine and not to Israel. Within Israel, there is no such thing as apartheid. I also made it plain in the book that I'm not referring to apartness or apartheid based on racism. It's based on the avarice of a minority of Israelis for Palestinian land. And the Israelis have permeated the West Bank and Gaza and so forth with settlements. They've now withdrawn from Gaza. They now have more than 200 settlements in the West Bank, deep within the West Bank, and those settlements are connected to other Israeli settlements inside the West Bank and in Jerusalem with major highways, and the major highways are forbidden to be used by Palestinians. In fact, in many cases, the Palestinians can't even cross one of those highways, so it's just like a spider web of Israeli roads connecting their settlements, and Israel controls the east side, that is the Jordan River Valley, and obviously the west side, Israel and the Mediterranean, and they are now squeezing the Palestinians every day with the construction of a high wall, in some cases, as I said, four stories high, through which the Palestinians can't go. And this wall is not built on Israeli land. It's built on Palestinian land. In fact, nowhere along that entire wall, which is three times as long as a border, by the way, is there any place where it separates Palestinians from Israelis. It just separates Palestinians from other Palestinians.
To Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Phil. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Mr. President, you made the comment that there was much blame to be passed around. Do you not believe that it was your lack of taking a stronger hand against Iran when they were holding our people hostage for so many days, not only holding those Americans hostage, but holding America hostage, that if you would have taken a stronger military stance, I know that many lives would have been lost, and we could have been caught into a quagmire then. But by taking a stronger stance now, then we would not be possibly into the quagmire that we are in today, having to deal and get into bed with people that we should not be taking bedfellows with.
A lot of people made the same point, obviously, when the hostages were being held, and that was a decision I had to make. As a matter of fact, when the Shah was overthrown and the Ayatollah Khomeini established his revolutionary government in Iran, we did have continued diplomatic relations with Iran. They had an office, obviously, of diplomats in Washington. We had one in Tehran, and those are the ones that were taken by the revolutionaries. I had a choice then. I could have destroyed Iran with the formidable military power that I controlled as commander-in-chief. In the process, every one of our hostages would instantly have been assassinated by the Iranians. consequence that I hoped to avoid. And I would have probably killed 10 or 20,000 completely innocent Iranians because a few militants were holding our hostages. I decided to do otherwise and to negotiate with the Iranians, and eventually, as you possibly know, every hostage came home safe and free, and no Iranians were killed either. I think the situation turned out for the best, but I don't think that the situation would be any better between us and Iran now if I had destroyed a major part of Iran with missiles and bombs.
If you had been president on September 11th, 2001, what would have been your action in response?
Substantially the same as the reaction of President Bush. I would have invaded Afghanistan. I would have tried to overthrow the Taliban government, and I would have concentrated on destroying Al-Qaeda and capturing Osama bin Laden. And I approved of that publicly at the time. Unfortunately, we abandoned all of those efforts, basically, and channeled our military and political power and the concentration of America's forces into Iraq.
Why do you think President Bush made that decision?
I think you'd have to ask him. I disagreed strongly with it, as you can probably tell by my previous statement. But in the process, we pretty well gave up the concerted effort to rebuild Afghanistan along democratic lines. We shifted hundreds of billions of dollars into Iraq, and we concentrated our military effort, as you know, into a fruitless project in Iraq. I think it was one of the most serious mistakes that our nation has ever made.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But, Mr. President, had you been president then, had you gone into Afghanistan, and had you not been able to find Osama bin Laden, would you have then simply brought the troops home?
No, I would have kept enough troops there, hopefully with the concerted support of the entire world. NATO is now there, and I would have tried to recruit, you know, Arab nations and others to join me in a concerted and common effort to rebuild Iraq, Afghanistan, which had been substantially damaged in the past by the Soviet invasion and so forth, and to give them a glimpse, maybe a clear picture, of the benefits to be derived from a democratic and free society. We didn't do that after the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan under President Reagan, and we didn't do it in this instance when we shifted our attention to Iraq. But I think Afghanistan is a nation that could have been converted to democracy on their terms, with the outside world providing them with massive assistance to rebuild their schools, their water systems, their sewage systems, their hospitals, and to give them a good life.
And considering where we are now in relation to the Islamic world, where do you see this world headed? Do you see conflict after conflict? Do you see a movement toward some kind of coming together? What do you see?
There are two keys to the future. One is to resolve the conflict or potential conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And that's something that the United States could do. It wouldn't cost us anything. And we would reap great benefits in public approbation and approval within the Muslim world. The second one is to withdraw in a proper way from Iraq and immediately to let it be known that the U.S. has no permanent desire to have a military base in that Muslim country, and at the same time to involve as many other nations as possible in the promise that would be fulfilled of rebuilding Iraq, repairing the damage of the invasion, and giving them full control in three ways: military, political, and economic, over their own affairs.
I asked you earlier whether you would talk to the current President Bush about these issues. Have you talked to the former President Bush?
No, not directly. I see him on occasion, primarily on events of a public nature, like the dedication of his own library, the dedication of the Clinton Library. I was with him on the celebration of the 200th birthday of the White House, things of that kind. My most intimate relationship since I left the White House has been with President Gerald Ford. He and I have helped each other with mutual problems. He has been one of our key supporters of the work the Carter Center does now in 65 nations in the world. And he's one of the best personal friends I've ever had. And Betty and Rosen are very close together because Betty is interested in alcoholism and drugs, and Rosen is interested in mental illnesses. So they even go to Washington and lobby together. So the Fords and Carters have been intimate friends.
Well, Mr. President, I do wish you success, not only on this book, but in your future efforts, your future travels to attain world peace. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Diane. I've enjoyed it once again.
Thank you. President Jimmy Carter, his book is titled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. And Jimmy Carter, of course, the winner of the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Elizabeth Terry. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.